Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. New cases of breast cancer, the most common female cancer, have been stable for about the last 10 years in the United States. This is in contrast to our topic last week, colorectal cancer, and actually several other kinds of cancers, which have actually had the situation of the rate of new cancers have been decreasing. Fortunately for breast cancer, death rates have been slowly improving, however. Our guest today is Dr. Heather Tauschek. She is a radiologist at Providence Imaging Center, in fact, the director of radiology there, and she's also director of breast imaging at the Imaging Center. We'll be discussing mammography today and the newest recommendations for breast cancer screening. Along the way, we'll hopefully help you understand why recommendations may change over time, why different very prominent organizations may have slightly different recommendations, and maybe even why the rates of new cancer cases can be level, but survival of for breast cancer can be improving. If you've got questions or comments at all during the program today, there's a couple of ways you can get in touch with us. In Anchorage, our local number is 550-8433. Let me give you that again, 550-8433. We also have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. And just a reminder, you have to spell out line one, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, line1@alaskapublic.org. Dr. Tauschek, it's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you very much for having me.
So let's start by just defining what mammography is. How does it work? What does it do?
A mammogram is a low-energy X-ray that is specifically tailored to look at the tissue of the breasts. It is used in both a screening capacity, in other words, trying to identify breast cancer very early. It is also used as one of many imaging modalities to evaluate a palpable lump, for example, or somebody who has a clinical symptom such as focal pain in the breast.
And you mentioned it's an X-ray, so let's get the idea of some risk to radiology off the table, or maybe we can't get it off the table, but define that risk a little bit for us. What's the risk of a mammogram?
I think you're asking me about the risk of radiation associated
right.
with mammography.
Right.
Mammography is a very low-dose photon energy, 24 keV, I think, compared to a chest X-ray, for example, which is about 140 keV. It is radiation, but it's a very, very low dose, analogous to a background exposure of, I think, maybe a month or two. All of us have background exposure mm-hmm. to radiation just by living and breathing, and mammography is very small and incremental compared to that.
And that risk that we all have day to day goes even higher as we go up in an airplane.
Correct. Or if you live at a high elevation like Denver, for
right.
example, that
right.
raises your risk more than a mammogram does.
And astronauts have a particular problem with
Correct.
This.
Correct. Yes, they do.
So what's different about a machine that does mammography than a machine that does, say, chest X-ray, for example?
Well, they are both radiation, but the type and the energy is tailored to the type of tissue being evaluated. So breast tissue is largely fatty tissue compared to chest X-rays, which have a lot of bone in the way. They've got the soft tissue of the heart. So the image and the physics of the image are optimized to create the best contrast at the lowest dose for the tissue being imaged.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of a mammogram, it's the breast tissue.
So basically, it's just a specialized X-ray machine that does its best work on tissues that are as dense as a breast.
Correct.
So how are mammograms done?
It depends on whether it's a screening mammogram or a diagnostic mammogram. The principle is still the same. The breast is actually placed in compression to stabilize it because motion artifact can degrade an image. And then a single view in a very certain types of projections are obtained. The projections are typically craniocaudal, which is from head to bottom, or from medial lateral, which is from the mid aspect to the lateral aspect of the breast. There are lots of variations that you can do for diagnostic screening. You can do magnification views, for example, if you really want to look at calcifications. But the standard screening mammogram is tailored to visualize the maximum amount of breast tissue and the minimum number of images. So a screening mammogram is typically two views of each breast, one in the craniocaudal position and one in the medial lateral oblique position.
And I guess it's almost self-evident. The reason we do mammograms as opposed to chest x-rays or opposed to a CT scan or opposed to an ultrasound is for this particular use, trying to identify cancers, this is the safest, most effective way to do that.
Correct. It's the lowest radiation exposure, number one. It is a very high-resolution modality compared to CT, which is relatively low resolution compared to an x-ray or a mammogram. Mm. So it really is the best way to identify calcifications, for example, or densities or distortion.
I often on the program will talk about what's the risk of doing something, what's the risk of not. And when we talk about the risk of doing something, what's the accuracy of it, what's the risk that that you're going to imply to it. So basically, it's that same kind of algorithm that's going on here. And it, for what we've got right now, for screening for breast cancer, this is the one that meets all those criteria the best.
It is. It has the highest sensitivity and specificity for your average risk patient. There are other ways to actually screen for breast cancer. We can do screening breast ultrasound, for example, and some studies have actually shown that ultrasound does detect an increased number of breast cancers over mammography, but the risk associated with that is 4 times the false positive rate. So we typically don't offer that at our institution to average risk women just because of that false positive rate is so high. Similar with breast MRI, you can do screening breast MRI, but it has a very high false positive rate. So we tend to reserve that for patients who are at a baseline high risk so that the odds of a finding on the MRI being a true finding are increased.
All right, let's define for listeners who may not be as up on this, false positive and false negative.
So a false positive, an example, would be when you get your screening mammogram and you are called back for some additional images. Those additional images show that there really is not a persistent abnormality in that area. And then 1 year later, you come back and you have no evidence of malignancy at 1 year. A false negative is a patient who has a negative mammogram but then comes back within a year with a diagnosis of cancer.
Let's, if you don't mind, just focus just for a second, because I think that may be important for listeners to hear, a false negative. So you do an x-ray, you do everything you think you can, everything we can see is there's negative, and yet you come back in a year or sometimes even earlier and things have really gotten out of hand. Why would that be?
There are 2 reasons. The first is that mammography is an imperfect modality. It's very good in women with very fatty breast tissue. I guess I'll back up a little bit and say that when we look at the breast tissue, we always characterize the type of a tissue. How easy is it to interpret, essentially? It ranges from entirely fatty, in which it's very easy to detect a cancer, through scattered fibroglandular densities, which is just a little bit of dense tissue, to heterogeneously dense breast tissue is where you're starting to get quite a bit more dense, and then extremely dense tissue. Mammography is very, very good in excluding cancer in women who have almost entirely fatty breast tissue. Once you get to the dense tissue, it's very easy to miss a cancer because you may just not see it because of the density of the tissue. Mm-hmm. So our false positive, false negative rates are related to that. Patients can have a false negative simply because they have such dense tissue that you can't see the cancer. The other reason that you can get a false negative is if a patient develops a very rapidly growing, very aggressive cancer, which is really, rather than the exam being false negative, that's really an interval cancer. The cancer just grew in the meantime. Mm-hmm. But those are the 2 most common reasons for having a false negative mammogram.
Let me remind listeners once again, this is Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. My guest today is Dr. Heather Tauchek. She's an expert in breast imaging, and we're talking about mammography in particular and recommendations for screening for breast cancer. This is I can't think of a better time. If you've got questions about screening for breast cancer, this is a good time to call. And let me give you a couple of ways to get a hold of us. Our local number, 550-8433. Locally, 550-8433. An email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. And we also have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. So, Heather, what I heard you say is for the average risk woman, for most women, it's very clear mammography is the best screening technique we have, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but there are always exceptions to the rule. So there are some women, based in particular on their kind of breast tissue they have, it may not be the best.
It may be imperfect.
All right.
I still would have to say that it's the best that we have to offer right now, but it is an imperfect modality. We are now adding on tomosynthesis, though, which is a three-dimensional type of a mammogram, which provides additional benefit, particularly in patients where standard mammography may miss cancers, and those are the patients with heterogeneously dense and extremely dense breast tissue. The three-dimensional mammography is analogous to a CAT scan in where we actually get slices through the breast. And so rather than getting a single summation image where you get one picture of the breast, you may get between 20 and 60 slices through a breast, depending on the size of that breast. And so you can actually pick up some masses. You can pick up distortion much better in those patients with the heterogeneously dense or extremely dense breast tissue. It actually, as a modality, helps us identify more invasive breast cancers, specifically the ones we really want to find, not the early non-invasive. It helps us find invasive cancers early.
We've mentioned, I guess I would interpret as a technical problem with mammography in that it's somewhat dependent on the tissue that you're looking at. If we ignore that or say we've already handled that, what are the other potential things you worry about with mammography from the way it's done? Could there be a technological problem with the technician who's working with the woman at the time, or the machine itself is, you know, somehow not in calibration well?
That's something we always pay attention to. It's very important for there to be no motion on a mammogram. We assess at the beginning, we assess each exam as we're interpreting it for technical adequacy. Is this a good study or is it not? If it's not a good study, we will actually call a patient back for an additional view to make sure that it is a good study. There are things that can be on the surface of the skin, for example. Deodorant is the most common one. That's why women are asked to not wear deodorant or wipe off deodorant before the exam. It's because it looks like calcifications on mammography, which is one of the things that we are actually looking for to detect early cancer. There can be some, obviously, there can always be machine artifacts, I mean, grid lines. It gets very technical, but there can be reasons for failure, but we actually assess for those when we are interpreting the exam to make sure that before we make a diagnosis or an assessment that it is a technologically good image or technically good image.
All right, so let's imagine for a second you've now had a mammogram done and it's sitting in front of you. How do you interpret that?
Well, everything that we have now is on a computer screen. So all of our imaging is digital. We are no longer using film screen because the digital technology is far superior. So what we do is we compare the old examinations to the new examinations. So I can look at last year's mammogram and see this year's mammogram all on the same screen. And what I often do is I'll start by comparing to the oldest that I have, maybe, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 years ago, because it makes it the easiest to see for subtle changes over long periods of time. And then what I do is I just page through the images and I look through each quadrant of each breast, depending on if it's a 2D exam or a 3D exam. I'll scroll through the whole series of images like a CAT scan. And then at the very end, we do still use computer-aided detection just to see if there's anything that possibly my eye may have missed. And then we sign off the examination.
What's your greatest fear about doing reading mammography?
Missing a cancer, yeah. Of course.
What do we know about reader validity on mammographies? So what I'm asking is, if I throw up the same mammogram in front of 10 radiologists, how reproducible are the findings?
Well, it depends, like many things in medicine, on your stage of training. You know, how long have you been doing this? How many of these do you read a year? Are you reading both screening exams? Or are you reading diagnostic exams as well? Mammography is actually regulated by the FDA and the MQSA, which is the Mammography Quality and Safety Act. And as part of that, we actually track all of our statistics. So we look at those on a quarterly basis, and I can tell you what the cancer detection rates of everybody who reads mammography in my group is. I can tell you what individual callback rates are. I can tell you what our, you know, there's a whole variety of quality metrics that we do track. And those were supposed to be within that expected range. And so even though within a group, you know, my cancer detection rate may be higher, but my callback rate may be slightly higher, there's somebody else in the group who has slightly lower of both of those. And so as a group, it ends up evening out. Mm-hmm. But we do, there are standard quality metrics, and I know that we are within those because we track them.
Right.
So there is some variability, but it's within an accepted range.
Right. I guess what I'm in a sense for myself, and I'm thinking for listeners, is it's so easy to just think this is a pretty simple operation, and you just go in, and there's 100% for surety I'm going to be able to trust the results. And life is not like that. And usually when we start looking into something, it turns out to be much, much more complex. I would have to say, from my point of view, that it is extremely nice to hear that you're honing down and looking at individual, how people are doing as far as reading those. And because outliers can help you learn a lot. Now, people that are extremely good, you'd like to know why that is, and people that are having some trouble, you need to know that as well.
Well, and in our group, too, another thing that we've done in the last year is we now send all of our data to the National Mammography Database. So it's an aggregate database of hundreds of thousands of mammogram examinations all over the country, varying from academic centers to private practice centers. And so I know how our data compares to other places of varying size and expertise across the country, and we actually look pretty good.
You may have said this, and I didn't catch it as I was kind of looking at my screens and so forth, but there is not felt to be a need for multiple observers on a single mammogram in general?
I would say that it's not standard practice. There are practices that do double read, partly because of our geographic location and size of our group. We don't. It's not common. Even in the academic center I trained in, they didn't double read. Some places do. Mm-hmm. I think it's more common in Europe than it is here.
I would guess that there may be times when you say to your associates, what do you think of this?
Oh, absolutely.
So it's not an official double read. It's getting a couple of opinions to make a decision.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
And in most things in medicine, it's safety first. So if there's any doubt, I would assume that your consciousness is saying, well, it may be more expensive, or maybe we got to do more radiology, but we need to get a better or another view of this.
I can't tell you how many times I sat looking at my screen thinking, I really don't think this is anything, but it's a subtle change,
right.
And I'm going to end up calling them back.
What's the risk of doing it? What's
Correct.
The risk of not doing it?
Absolutely.
That's what
I agonize over that on a daily basis.
Linda, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I'm a breast cancer survivor, and I had received a false negative on my mammography. It was only because I was able to feel the lump that I was able to go back to the doctor. They did another mammogram, still didn't see it, did an ultrasound, and it showed up as clear as the sun. So my point of contention with my doctor is I feel like mammograms, in my case, because she said I do have dense tissue, that it would be a waste of time. I should just do the ultrasound. Mm-hmm. She continues to believe I should get the mammogram, but I wanted to get your thoughts on that because I feel the exact opposite.
Yeah, very, very good question. So in your particular case, would mammograms still be the modality of choice for screening for a recurrence, I guess, is part of what you have to think about, or a new breast cancer. Is that right?
Yes.
All right.
So I will answer that by saying a couple of things. What you're describing is not uncommon. When I was a fellow and a resident, one of my attendings told me, above all else, always respect a palpable lesion. In other words, even if the mammogram is negative, if somebody has a lump, you take it very seriously and you look at it with another imaging modality. There are things that we can see on mammography that are not just masses that can be associated with cancer. It sounds to me like your cancer presented as a mass, but some women have cancers that present as what we call architectural distortion, or some women have cancers that present purely as calcifications, which are not well seen on ultrasound and, in fact, can be flat-out missed on ultrasound. So we have to use multiple imaging modalities that complement each other when we're evaluating patients. In patients who have dense tissue now, in my facility, we are doing tomosynthesis, which has extra benefit in women who have heterogeneously dense, particularly, or extremely dense tissue, which can help us find that. But, you know, I would say that still we do continue to use mammography even in women with extremely dense or heterogeneously dense tissue because there can be subtle findings on the mammogram that we would flat out miss with an ultrasound.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay. What are radiologists looking for on the X-ray? You mentioned some things just a minute ago in your discussion with Linda, and we hadn't really asked you specifically. So what are you looking for and why?
We look for, first of all, masses, obviously, because cancer can often present as a mass. We look for calcifications, which I often tell patients are analogous to grains of sand. They come up and show as little specks of white on the X-ray. They can have varying shapes, but that's one of the items that we look for. Some cancers can present purely by increasing breast density on one side that's not developing on the left. So we might call that an asymmetry or a developing density. Basically, any change in the density or the appearance of the breast that's localized to one area. Or distortion, and that is a type of a scarring that can develop. You can see it after surgery is a common thing that causes distortion, but you can also see it in cancers because they can tether and pull the ligaments in the breast in and create sort of a star appearance. So that's another thing that we look for with mammography.
Calcifications. Why would calcifications show up?
Calcifications often develop in ductal carcinoma in situ, which is, it's considered a cancer, even though it's non-invasive. It's a non-invasive form of malignancy, although the terminology is a little bit under contention or discussion at this point. Invasive ductal cancers can also present with calcifications and lobular lesions, both atypia, which is not cancer, but it's sort of a borderline high-risk lesion, can also develop calcifications. One of the problems, one of the challenges in mammography is ascertaining what calcifications are benign and which ones are not. There are some that, when you see them on mammography, are clearly benign. One is called milk of calcium, for example. It sort of layers out like sand would if you put it in a jar of water. It'll layer out. Milk of calcium is benign. There are others that you look at, and they're pleomorphic and broken. It's really hard to describe without, you know, pointing to an image, but those are terms that we use to describe things that are highly suspicious for cancer. And then there's a whole garden variety in between that are just indeterminate, and we don't know what they are. We can make a guess. I can say, oh, probably 10% chance of cancer, 50% chance, maybe a little bit more than 50%, but we don't know until we do the biopsy. And that's one of the reasons that we end up doing biopsies in women who have something new that develops on their mammogram. It's not always a mass, but we do many calcifications or biopsies for calcifications.
Boy, that just, in my mind, brought up a whole nother layer of expertise that's required in this, and you can begin to understand why there's specialized training and just looking at mammograms. How much time did you spend just in training at looking at mammograms?
In my residency, I spent several months, and I actually did a fellowship in breast imaging. So I spent an additional year just learning how to use all the different imaging modalities and to train my eye.
So just because you see calcium doesn't mean it's breast cancer. It's what kind of calcium, how it acts, whether it tethers, whether it's displacing tissue.
What the shape of it is.
Shape of it.
Mm-hmm. Its distribution. That's an important one.
Yeah. And then the difference in density from one breast to the other could be a pretty subtle change.
Yes. Actually, many women ask on their baseline mammogram or if they haven't had a mammogram in a long time and they have a lump on one side, they ask, well, why do I have to get both breasts imaged?
Right.
And it's because the breasts are typically symmetric from patient to patient. And so if there's an asymmetry, that may prompt me to recommend a biopsy or look more closely. So that's why we typically will do bilateral mammograms for a unilateral lump.
What about age and the effects on mammography? How does age affect the accuracy of mammography, for example?
It does. Younger women typically have more dense breast tissue because of the effect of estrogen. As women age, they lose that estrogen stimulation, just particularly when they go through menopause. You'll often see a change in the density of their breast tissue. We know that mammography is more accurate and has higher sensitivity and specificity in women who have entirely fatty breasts. And on top of that, cancer is more common in older women. So all of those mean that mammography is a better tool in the slightly older patient population, but it's still useful in younger patients.
And one other thing I'd like to kind of get out on the table before we take our break is you mentioned carcinoma in situ. So I am supposing that many listeners will think breast cancer is breast cancer is breast cancer. So can you put a little little description on the variability of breast cancer?
There are many different types of breast cancers, and they range in degree or in degree of severity. The two predominant types are lobular and ductal. Those have to do with different structures within the breast. So you can develop cancer in the lobule, you can develop cancer in the ducts. There are invasive forms of lobular carcinoma and invasive forms of ductal carcinoma, and those can range in severity and degree. They can be low grade, they can be high grade, they can have estrogen and progesterone receptor positivity, they can have estrogen and progesterone receptor negativity. All of those are important because medications that affect those receptors are used in treatment of breast cancer, and so we have to know what the status of that is on the tissue. And then there's some lesions that are atypia, so they're high-risk lesions, but they're not necessarily cancerous, but have to be treated surgically. And then there are the in situ lesions, so lobular carcinoma in situ and ductal carcinoma in situ. Currently, ductal carcinoma in situ in most cases is treated as a cancer. The patient may have lumpectomy, they may have radiation therapy. Not always. If it's a low-grade carcinoma in situ, they may not necessarily treat with radiation, but it is often treated as though it is an invasive cancer.
So when you say in situ, you said it earlier, but I want to make it clear again, that is non-invasive. It hasn't gone through
the basement membrane.
Basement membrane of the cells.
Correct.
In the structure it's in. So it's certainly not elsewhere in the body, at least as far as we can tell. And we know that's in situ after a biopsy. We can't tell it from mammography alone.
Typically, correct. There may be some clues on mammography. I mean, often DCIS will present with calcifications. And there are some calcifications that I can look at and say, well, I think this is probably going to be low grade. I'm not 100% mm-hmm. accurate, but I do mm-hmm. check my pathology after mm-hmm. every time I make a biopsy recommendation.
Yep.
I do that correlation. Yep. So there can be some clues, but we won't know until you actually see the tissue. And really, the gold standard is the surgical excision, not the biopsy, because you can actually undersample in a biopsy.
Sure. All right. Other questions, but why don't we take our break? Let me remind listeners once again, you're listening to Line One, your health connection. Our local number is 550-8433, 550-8433. We have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a one-minute break, and then we'll continue our discussion on mammography and really get into the current recommendations for screening for breast cancer with Heather Talchek. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line One from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line One on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Joining us today on Line One is Providence Imaging Cancer Center radiologist, actually director of radiology with the Providence Imaging Center, Dr. Heather Talchek. More importantly, she is also the director of breast imaging for Providence Imaging Center as well. And we're discussing mammography, which we've spent a lot of time on in the first 30 minutes of the program. And we're going to focus a little bit more on the second half of the program on some of the newer recommendations, why they may be a little bit different. Sometimes, I think, unfortunately confusing for that reason. in the next half hour or so. I would strongly urge you, if you have questions or comments, to take advantage of this particular time. You can email questions to her at line1@alaskapublic.org over the next 30 minutes. You can talk to her personally in the next 30 minutes at 550-8433, 550-8433. And we also have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Remember, if you're listening between 8 and 9 p.m. on Monday evenings, you're listening to a taped rebroadcast, and we won't be able to answer your questions at that time. However, at any time, you can go to the AlaskaPublic.org website, get the Line 1 link from KSKA, and you can look at our archives and listen to the program again, or even refer somebody you think would like to listen to it. So, Heather, let's define one more term, and that's, you use the term high-grade, low-grade when talking about different kinds of cancers. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's a reflection of what the pathologists see when they actually look at the tissue sample. But what it fundamentally means is how metabolically active is the lesion. Is it rapidly dividing? Does it have a lot of mitotic figures that would be for a rapidly dividing lesion? Or does it look like it's fairly indolent and non-aggressive? Those have important prognostic implications for long-term survival. That's one of the reasons that they specifically look at the grading. And it helps determine the treatment plan that a particular patient may take.
So when you say prognostic factor and that different cancers are at low-grade or high-grade, I interpret that in my mind being a male of prostate cancer. So we know that a lot of men die with prostate cancers on board and didn't even know they had them, and that a lot of men with prostate cancer will die of something else before they die of prostate cancer. Is the same true, then, you're saying, of breast cancer?
Absolutely. There are some breast cancers that are very indolent and slow-growing, and there are other ones that will double in weeks and can grow incredibly rapidly.
And that gets really important when we think about what we're going to do to women who have something suspicious on mammography.
Correct. It's something I talk to patients about frequently because I have a fair number of patients who come in, they're still getting their screening mammograms in, you know, late 70s or even the early 80s, and they may have a host of other medical problems. And they say to me, you know, I've got so many other medical issues, and, you know, I don't think even if I got diagnosed with a breast cancer that I would even go through with any treatment. And I tell them that that's actually very valid, particularly if we find out that it is a low-grade lesion. You have to take into account what's going on in a patient's scenario, their medical scenario. Do they have a lot of other issues? Or, on the other hand, are they a young woman with a very high-grade lesion that could potentially be lethal? You might approach those patients very differently.
This is along the same line of an email that I just got where the writer says, it's confusing to me why older women are told to get a mammogram less frequently than annually when his likelihood of getting breast cancer increases as each year as the woman ages, which I think both facts are true. Can you explain why that's the recommendation?
Well, I think this alludes to the fact that there are some differing recommendations for screening out there. The American College of Radiology and the Society for Breast Imaging, which is one of the bodies that works closely and represents radiologists, actually recommends screening every year, regardless of your age, starting at the age of 40. The U.S. Preventive Task Forces, their updated guidelines recommend starting at the age of 50 and going every other year. So there are differing recommendations out there. It is true that breast cancer becomes more common as you get older, but I think breast cancer tends to be more aggressive in younger women. We can go into the American Cancer Society recommendations, which were recently released and updated. In the past, the American Cancer Society followed the American College of Radiology and the Society of Breast Imaging in recommending screening every year starting at the age of 40. That's purely because by doing that, we catch the most cancers. We may be catching cancers that are not going to kill patients by doing that, by increasing that screening. We are going to result in patients having more biopsies and more diagnostic workup. When you switch to every other year, that does decrease the callback rates. It decreases the number of biopsies because just by doing every other year, you actually have a two-year comparison, which is the standard for stability. So if we're looking at something from 2 years ago and we say, oh, we see this mass on this patient's mammogram, but it's been there 2 years ago, we know that that's stable. We're not going to do anything about it. The problem with that is that there are these cancers that grow incredibly rapidly, and those are the ones that we really want to find. Those are the ones that are the clinically significant ones. They're the ones that young women die and don't raise their children. You know, those are the ones that we want to find. And in the past, people had only looked at these 10-year increments, you know, 40 to 50, 50 to 60, 60 to 70. One of the nice things that the American Cancer Society did recently with their new recommendations is they looked at ages by 5 years rather than 10 years to say, okay, well, let's break it down into 5-year increments and see, you know, what kind of cancers we're going to find. And they actually compared in those 5-year brackets, they compared the number of cancers that were significant essentially in people who underwent screening every year compared to people who went, women who underwent screening every other year. And they actually found between the age of 45 and 55 that you really should get mammograms every single year, because if they, those patients who went to 2 years ended up having larger tumors, they had, you know, greater disease, greater stage of disease. And so they really demonstrated nicely that if you're going to do every other year between 40 to 45 and 55, you're going to be missing clinically significant cancers. On the flip side, they found that between the age of 55 and on up, that really they weren't seeing that difference in the staging. And so their recommendation is that between 40 to 45 is when you start getting your screening mammogram, and you get it every single year until the age of 55. At 55, they say, then you can go to every other year.
Up until, I think, is there an endpoint criteria at 80 or 10 years expected life expectancy? And that's because why?
So a lot of places, again, it varies. Some people will say 75, some people say 80. Typically what I'll tell patients is, and with talking with their physicians, if there's 10 years expected life expectancy, in other words, is the patient pretty healthy? Are they active? Do they not have any other medical issues? If, again, it alludes to what we discussed earlier. If you have a patient who has severe diabetes and they've had amputations and they're immobile and they may have had a number of strokes and heart disease, really, you're not going to be improving their quality of life by diagnosing a breast cancer in that patient. And they may physically not be able to sustain the treatment or undergo the treatment. And so I think those are things to consider. And it's important for patients to sit and discuss with their primary care provider. Okay, do you think that this is a good thing for me to be doing? Is it going to have any benefit in my situation?
Okay. Sue, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Well, hi. I had an annual last summer with my primary physician, and I'm 62, and I had a silver plan coverage for self-employed, and they only cover screenings. So when I went in last summer, the physician felt a ridge on my left breast, so she immediately requested diagnostic screening instead of baseline screening, which put me in the category of not being covered by my insurance company. So then I went for diagnostic, and they couldn't determine. At that point, they sent me to Alaska Regional for a sonogram, and when I went to my sonogram appointment, there was a reader, a radiologist, I guess, across the hallway, and they looked at it and couldn't determine at that point still. So they wanted to do another sonogram the following week. And I asked them, well, why did you need to do another one? Why couldn't you have done the needle biopsy when you had me in here the first time and you actually saw the screening? And they said, well, we needed your doctor's authorization. Well, you know, they don't think of the terms of insurance coverage. So right. Is there any way that a physician can refer you to the diagnostic and the sonogram and say, and leave it up to the reader or to determine whether they need the needle biopsy done while you're there the first time when you have a sonogram, rather than exposing the patient to another sonogram a week later? And my goodness, when I got my billing at the end of all this, it was $6,000. And there was nothing that they could see that required any further treatment.
And none of that was covered.
Right. And I had a silver plan under MOTA with the, you know, ACA.
Okay, number of questions you asked there. Let's see what Dr. Tauchek has to say.
It's a little hard for me to understand exactly what transpired on the radiologist end without having looked at those orders. I'm a little unclear, did you actually undergo a biopsy or you just had a repeat ultrasound within a week?
Yes, first of all, I've had screening for 20 years, so they had lots of records. But yes, I was, the first reading was sonogram only to determine if there was something there, and they couldn't quite determine that, so then they wanted to do a needle biopsy the following week.
Okay, so you had a biopsy then?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, anytime that there's a lesion that's palpable, or in other words, you feel a lump or your doctor feels a lump, it is standard of care to actually do an ultrasound. And partly that's because there are certain things that can be missed by mammography, as we talked about previously. There was somebody who called in who said, I had a cancer. It wasn't even seen on mammogram, but it was clear as day on the ultrasound. So if there's something on the ultrasound that correlates to the palpable lump, in most cases, if it does not look like a characteristically benign lesion, in other words, we can look at it and say with a very large degree of certainty, this is not cancer, typically we will recommend that you have a biopsy. In some cases, that can be done same day, but often it's not purely because of scheduling issues. For many of our out-of-town patients, for example, if somebody comes in from Barrow or whatnot and they have something, we may actually hold a spot for them that day because we know that we need to make sure that they get taken care of. But purely because of scheduling issues is often why patients have to come back, because we just have, you know, limited staffing to do biopsies on everybody who presents that same day. And the other thing is that many patients don't need a biopsy. So it's really kind of inefficient from the medical system perspective to hold a slot for a biopsy for somebody who really doesn't need one. We do, if your physician requests it, if they say a biopsy same day, we will hold a slot, but it's one of those things that we need to know about preemptively from your provider.
Right, and that's where I wish the providers would be more efficient and think about ultimately what needs to be done, because the person reading the sonogram was sitting right across the hall, and the minute he determined that something that he couldn't really tell and he wanted to do a needle biopsy, I don't understand why they couldn't save cost by just doing it then while they had me there, because I don't think that having two sonograms is, you know, exposing yourself to more radiation, it's unnecessary when they know that they need to get a needle biopsy. And he said, the excuse he gave was he needed to get permission from my physician. And I said, well, the physician isn't reading it. Naturally, she's going to tell you to go ahead and do a needle biopsy. So I didn't understand that part. That's what, and I think I got charged twice for sonogram, and they're pretty expensive.
Well, probably what happened is you had a diagnostic ultrasound, and then when you came back for your biopsy, you had an ultrasound-guided biopsy. So the ultrasound is needed to actually guide the biopsy for something that's seen only with ultrasound. Ultrasound is not radiation, too, just so you know. It's actually a sound wave. So there's not the same concern with radiation exposure as perhaps with mammography. So it's a relatively benign imaging modality. Typically what will happen is we do have to get an order from the referring provider, because one of the rules in healthcare is that we are not allowed to self-refer. Because obviously if I were to image anybody who came through, people would say, oh, I'm just doing that for my own financial interest. So the reason that you have to go back to your doctor is a couple-fold. Number one, to discuss with them, because they know you best, whether or not this is a procedure you should undergo. And number two, as an extra check and balance to make sure that we're not requesting too many procedures or over-imaging. Having said that, we do have some clinician offices that do send us, you know, requests for biopsy if indicated, and they allow us to make the decision whether or not we need to do a biopsy. But that varies by provider. Some providers like to be able to read your imaging report and then talk to you about it and then proceed.
So what I'm hearing, you guys square me up, you were going to need two ultrasounds anyway, but what could have potentially happened is some increased communication between the radiologist and the ordering physician to say, if this seems like it's going to go ahead and need to be have a biopsy, it could have been done at the same time and saved you another. Yeah. It makes
sense.
Yes,
very much so. Yep. And I really think that with the coverages nowadays, that the physicians need to be really way more aware of what you know, the patient has to pay for and what they don't, especially when you don't work for a company with insurance coverage that's much better than being self-employed or, you know, an independent coverage. They just don't seem to be as, you know, as good a plan as the group coverage for employers. So
right.
No, I ended up paying, I thought, you know, twice as much for the way it went, and that's what I wasn't happy about.
Right. Yeah, it seems to me maybe that wasn't quite true, but it was certainly more inconvenient. But, you know, the other point is that insurance companies are mandated, except with very few exceptions, to pay for normal screening. They are not, and I think they have to do that as part of the coverage. So it's not there's no deductible or anything. But when it's diagnostic, that's not true. So you get caught. You got caught in that problem as well.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay.
Yep. I'm glad everything turned out okay. What one of the questions I have in my mind? What about screening now for you? What are the recommendations? How is this gonna?
Right, that's what I asked about.
How is that gonna change now for you?
Well, I believe they do want to have me back this year, but they inserted a little tiny metal device, I guess, inside so that next time they do a reading, they can see where the area was that they did a sonogram on so that they kind of know what to, you know that it's that area has already been.
Don't overreact to this or recognize we've already analyzed this thing unless it's some significant change
but
in there.
I don't know whether they're going to ask for a screening, a baseline screening this time, or immediately ask for diagnostic. But I sure hope they don't ask for diagnostic because the mammogram, the diagnostic mammogram, had a few more views on it, but again, like I said, it wasn't covered by insurance at all the minute they said diagnostic. So if it's coded that way, it's not covered.
Yeah, one of the things I would do if I was you is make sure you're talking to somebody about what they ask for and make sure your physician knows that you don't get diagnostics covered for.
Right. And I always check now with my insurance company before I make an appointment with the doctor because I want to know in advance what I'm covered for and what scenarios wouldn't be covered. And because when you end up, you know, having to be more responsible and paying for more of your coverage, then, you know, you just right away you want to know in advance what might occur and how much you're going to have to pay.
Right.
Yeah.
Good luck
out
there.
Okay, well, thanks a lot for taking my call.
All right, well, thanks for calling, Sue. We've talked about the recommendations, and one issue that comes up about the recommendations is most of them qualify that by average risk women. What does that mean? So the recommendations are for average risk women, and so they're excluding somebody. Why are they excluding them, and what makes them those other people different?
Well, they are excluding a different population, the high risk women, because our screening recommendations are actually different for high risk women. The average risk of breast cancer is about 1 in 8 or 12%. Women over their lifetime will develop a breast cancer. Things that would make you higher risk would be one or multiple primary relatives or first degree relatives with a premenopausal breast cancer. Any family history with a ovarian cancer is a big one. Any woman who has a known genetic mutation like BRCA1, BRCA2, these are gene mutations that predispose you to developing both ovarian and breast cancer, or Li-Fraumeni or P53 and P10 mutations. These are other well-characterized mutations that put you at significantly increased risk of developing a breast cancer. So for those patients, we would recommend that they have their annual screening mammogram in addition to a screening breast MRI. Many patients will have those at the same time, or in some cases they'll alternate them every 6 months. So they may have their mammogram, go 6 months to their MRI, go 6 months to their mammogram in order to help pick up those interval cancers. Because in these high-risk patients, not only do they have a predisposition to developing breast cancer, they typically develop very high-grade aggressive breast cancers. And so we recommend increased screening for this patient population.
Why are there some variations among different organizations? What are the a couple of reasons you might be able to help people understand that?
In the screening recommendations for average risk women?
Yes.
Partly, the United States Preventive Task Force didn't have a breast cancer specialist on their panel. So many of us in the breast imaging world and the breast cancer treatment world feel like that our expertise was underrepresented and not taken into account. I think screening every other year is more cost efficient. So you have to take that into consideration, particularly from the USPTF, because they are looking from a Medicare perspective in particular. And then on the other hand, on the flip side, I mean, the American College of Radiology recommends screening every year purely because we know that you'll catch the most cancers. But again, that does come with increased expense and increased, you know, patient procedure. So that's part of the reason it's important to discuss with your primary care provider.
Yeah, and that gets into this whole issue of risk perception. Women, it appears from studies, will almost always feel like more is better. And that's not necessarily true. And that raises a question we haven't talked about, and that's a potential complication of mammography is overdiagnosis. And so what does that mean?
The issue of overdiagnosis relates to breast cancers that probably will never, ever kill a person. So typically these are going to be, for example, a low-grade ductal carcinoma in situ or a low-grade, low mitotic rate breast cancer invasive carcinoma that really is not significantly enlarging. I can talk about this anecdotally because we have a few patients in our patient population who are in their 80s and 90s and had a breast cancer diagnosed, and they opted to not do anything about it. And all we do is just monitor them every 6 months or a year with a mammogram just to make sure that it's not going to cause some local complications like skin erosion or something like that. So I just lost my train of thought here.
Talking about
Overdiagnosis.
Yeah.
So, but the problem is that with overdiagnosis, they estimate that about 20% of breast cancers are overdiagnosed, meaning they lead to surgeries, radiation therapy, possibly even chemotherapy that are not necessarily going to be beneficial for the patient, and they have to undergo those relatively arduous treatments. The problem that we have is we still don't have good tools to determine which cases are going to be high grade and potentially, you know, concerning, and which cases are really not going to affect a patient over their lifetime. More and more, we are learning about the genetic basis of cancer. And there is a test out there that some of the oncologists are using, a pathologist are using, on tissue samples taken from the time of surgery or for the time of pathology. And it's called Oncotype DX, and it's basically a gene assay. And they look at the genetic displaying of genes in certain types of cancer, and they can compare them to the genes that are exposed in that cancer or displayed in that cancer compared to another one. And they can actually look at risk models over time and say, okay, well, we can look at this population and the gene profile of this cancer and say that the chance of you having a 10-year or in-breast recurrence in 10 years is pretty high, so we're going to go ahead and give you all the treatments that we have. In comparison, somebody who has a low-grade ductal carcinoma in situ, they may do this exam and find out that their gene profile is actually relatively low and their risk of developing an in-breast recurrence is very low, and so they may not do radiation. So I think we're becoming more personalized. We're starting to learn more about the biology of cancer, but overall we're not there yet. And until we're there yet, we don't want to miss any cancers, and we can't really differentiate easily which ones are going to be highly concerning and which ones aren't. So it's a process. We need more data, and we need more research studies before we can be definitive.
So in a sense, another reason that recommendations change is we have more information. As we get more information, we have more questions, and we have to look
Absolutely.
At studies a little bit differently. But science generally proceeds that way by ups and downs, but we keep honing in a little bit better and better. And there's no other example of that is probably where we're going with cancer therapy right now. Another thought that came to my mind about this. Now I have forgot is about the genes. My thought was, my understanding was, and I could be wrong on this, is that many cancers actually have many genetic mutations, and that cancers are often there for a long period of time before they even become manifest. And that it takes several different mutations over time to really make them a bad guy. So now if we've got a oncotype, we're going to
biopsy, we're going to do some gene studies. We know what a person's genetic risk may be, and I'm going to say that very carefully, at that particular time. That doesn't mean it doesn't change over time either. So I'm not sure I see an end result, an end to this. It's still pretty doggone complex as you begin to understand the biology of cancers.
And that's why we continue to recommend screening the way that we right. do, because we still don't know. You know, I'm well aware that there are cancers that probably never will kill a patient, but I just can't tell the difference. And mm-hmm. until we know how to, we have to proceed the way that
there's
we are.
There's a link on our website to an article in the New England Journal of Medicine by Lisa Rosenbaum, which is a very useful, if you really want to get into this decision-making, because physicians are caught to try to do the best they can for their physician, for their patients from a health standpoint. And the patient often is making decisions based on how they perceive risk, which is often very emotional. And when you really start thinking about that and get down into it, it can get very, very difficult to even for the idea that we're going to individualize how we're going to make recommendations to somebody. From a physician standpoint, we might say your risk of having overdiagnosis is pretty great. That could lead to some problems. A woman is saying, I don't care. I want to know if I've got cancer. And they're so, you know, she makes the editorial or article makes a very good case for the difficulty of making some of these decisions, which seem to be in a patient's best interest, but the patient can't quite see it the same way.
Well, I see that frequently, too, because often a patient, for example, who had a mother diagnosed with breast cancer at the age of yep. 85 will consider herself to be very high risk because her mother had breast cancer. But that really doesn't put her at risk. If her mother had been, you know, 35 with a premenopausal breast cancer, that would put her at risk. But I think
she's not at risk because the rate of natural occurring breast cancers increases with age, so it doesn't make her at any greater risk.
Correct. But she might think that I'm extremely yep. high risk and I have to get my annual mammogram. And then on the other side, there are patients who are so concerned about a biopsy, you know, and there's so much fear associated with the biopsy, which a painless procedure. And patients are often shocked when they leave and they think that it was going to be horrible. And it's a painless procedure that was very easy. And so I think there's a lot of fear of the unknown that goes into those decisions, too. So there's always flip sides to the coin.
Right. Again, gets much more complex when you really start looking into things. Listen, this is, for me, it's very, very exciting hour. I enjoy this kind of conversation. Hopefully, listeners got as much out of it as I did. I want to say thanks very much, but also ask you, what do you want listeners to take away? Well, you know, it's always, we're not going to take away very much information and remember it for very long. What do you want women in particular to hear today?
Get your screening mammogram, because there's a 30% mortality benefit by doing that.
Okey-doke. Thanks very much. Appreciate you taking the time to be here, Heather. So my thanks to our guest, Heather Tauchek of the Providence Imaging Center. If you want to continue some discussion on mammography recommendations to screen for breast cancer, you can join KSKA on Facebook, and you can find that link at alaskapublic.org, where you'll also find that link to the Line 1 archives I mentioned earlier. And by the way, you can also leave us suggestions or thoughts for the program and for other potential topics. Next week, Line 1 is going to return. We're going to talk about multiple sclerosis, which is a variable, potentially disabling disease of the brain that is really kind of fascinating and will teach us a little bit about our immune system. So why not tune in next Monday, March 21st at 2 p.m. For that program as well. Let me remind you that Pat Yeck is our chief content officer at Alaska Public Media. Dave Waldron engineered today's program. Eric Bork was our web editor. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.